This is audiobook in MP3 of Remote Depossession, of Irene Hickman. 1994. From unreanwisdom.com/remote-depossession/9.July/2018. Numbers read between sometimes, maybe site index, page numbers. Forward. If I had not known Irene Hickman for over 30 years, I doubt that I could have been persuaded to write this forward. I am well aware of how preposterous her story must seem to the uninitiated reader who chanced to pick up this volume. To put any credence at all in what she has to say, one has to be willing, at a minimum, to assume, A, that there is a non-physical part of the self which does not die when the physical body dies, B, that because of various circumstances associated with the person's death, this soul entity in some instances fails to progress onward with its own further evolution but instead comes to reside in another physically living body. In other words, that spirit possession appears in some sense to be a real phenomenon. C. That this condition, which is generally disadvantageous to the unsuspecting host person, can sometimes be treated successfully through persuading the parasitic entity to move on toward the light, and D. That it is possible for this to be accomplished remotely, without the conscious awareness of the host individual, although presumably with the knowledge and assent of that individual's higher self. To modern science has taken a dim view of the first proposition, although on rather shaky grounds. Pervading practically all of science is the assumption that its basic information inputs are essentially limited to the data of physical sense perception. That being the case, it is not surprising that evidence suggesting a non-physical but nonetheless real aspect of human experience tends to experience ostracism. Most practitioners of hard science would claim that this is simply a matter of Occam's razor, or the principle of parsimony: never introduce a new concept if the phenomena can be explained without it. However, recent work with near-death experiences, regression therapy, children's memories of past lives, and other related areas indicates that a more tolerant attitude may be forming. The second and third propositions are supported by the work on spirit releasement therapy as reported in the recent books, by Edith Farr, Ph.D., The Unquiet Dead, Dolphin Doubleday, 1987, by William Baldwin, Spirit Releasement Therapy, Human Potentials Foundation Press, Falls Church, Virginia, 1993, and The Brief Treatment of Spirit Possession in the impressive two-volume treatise, Regression Therapy, A Handbook for Professionals, Winifred Lucas, Ph.D., ed., 1993, Deep Forest Press, Crest Park, California. It is the fourth proposition which comprises the novel contribution of Dr. Hickman. Having trained in spirit release therapy under William Baldwin, she became concerned about the difficulty of distinguishing between effects attributable to release of a possessing entity and the effects due to the suggestions of the therapist. Thus she developed a method of remote treatment, such that the one being treated need not know of or consciously participate in the process. This book is an accounting of that novel treatment method. Obviously, this work needs to be replicated by many other therapists before the healing community will give much credence to it. At this point, Dr. Hickman makes no claim other than an honest reporting. But because there will be a temptation to dismiss her report without a hearing, we need to comment on why it is not totally outrageous. The idea that someone might be possessed by some discarnate being is one that many of us may have felt should have been left behind with the Middle Ages. True, there have been reports of possession-like phenomena in every culture and every era. True, psychical researchers around the turn of the century investigated many such cases and took the spirit attachment hypothesis seriously. But surely, with our present degree of scientific sophistication, we can dismiss the idea of spirit possession as a pre-scientific concept for explaining phenomena we would now interpret in more scientifically acceptable terms. Perhaps Harvard philosopher, scientist, William James, was much concerned about this kind of puzzle. He felt science had been unduly restrictive in adopting an epistemology of positive empiricism, that is, whatever we know scientifically is known through empirical research in the physically measurable world. He proposed casting the scientific net more widely, with an epistemology of radical empiricism. In his Essays in Radical Empiricism, James defines the term thus: to be radical, an empiricism must neither admit into its construction any element that is not directly experienced, nor exclude from them any element that is directly experienced, and that nothing within the totality of human experience should be excluded from being a potential topic of scientific investigation. How widely he meant this to be applied is indicated by the fact that he was involved for 25 years with exploration of psychic phenomena, spiritism and religious experience. He was not convinced of the conclusions of enthusiasts in these areas, but he insisted that the experiences are appropriate data for a complete science. James' radical empiricism admits data from the senses, and thus includes within its purview the experience of the physical world. But it also encompasses the broad spectrum of inner realities found within the subjective life of the person. It also implies that no phenomena are to be excluded from investigation solely on the basis that they violate known scientific laws. Looking at human experience through the eyes of James' radical empiricism, we must be impressed by the diverse realms of reported experience which imply something like non-material self, what Western science appears unable to accommodate. For example, out-of-body experience, experiencing one's center of consciousness and perception to be somewhere other than behind the eyes, for instance, as above, looking down on the physical body, and near-death experiences are apparently far more common than we usually take them to be, and often lead to a conviction that the eye is something different from the physical body. Research on childhood memories of past lives has turned up numerous cases where the veridicality of the memories was substantiated. While alternative hypotheses are possible, the data strongly suggests something like the Eastern concept of reincarnation. Additional support for taking the spirit concept seriously comes from research on mediumistic communication purporting to come from persons no longer living. For several decades either side of the turn of the century, a great number of competent scientists, particularly in England, but including William James and others in the US, were interested in these communications which supposedly originated from the spirits of the deceased. Again, while alternative hypotheses are certainly possible, some of the cases were quite evidential in the sense that information showed up which was known to the deceased but not otherwise available to the medium. In addition, there are anthropological reports from other cultures indicating that in their perceived realities, spirit manifestation and possession are not all that unusual. Thus it appears that spirit attachment, or possession, may be a far more common condition than is commonly recognized. If so, if there are indeed intrusions into the human system by unwelcome non-physical parasites, then it is essential that people be made aware of it and that more practitioners, both in the mental health professions and in the clergy, be trained to use the appropriate techniques to relieve the condition. If, furthermore, the techniques of remote depossession prove to be effective, and others can be trained to use them, much of human suffering can be relieved. That is a lot of ifs. The jury is still out, undoubtedly. Meanwhile, at the very least, Dr. Hickman's Hook is a fascinating read and raises some most interesting questions. Willis W. Harmon, January, 1994. Preface to Second Edition. It has been most gratifying to learn of the rapidly growing interest in remote depossession during the 2.5 years since this book first appeared. I am happy to present a second edition with larger print than the first, which was my first attempt at a whole book working alone at the computer. In January, 1996, we formed the Depossession Institute, a membership organization which is intended to further knowledge and skill in depossession and remote depossession, and to further educate the public about the value and availability of this service. The administrative headquarters phone number is 1-800-210-0353. Plans include annual conferences in April, newsletter, journal, an anthology and additional publications of pamphlets and or books produced by our members. Success stories continue to pour in from depossession practitioners, who are achieving result including cases in which traditional medical or psychological treatments have failed. Introduction. There is a growing awareness among health professionals that it has become imperative to look beyond the traditional views of mainline psychology in medicine. With a rapidly expanding body of evidence supporting the concept of personal survival of bodily death, we must now look beyond the narrow views of behavioral psychology in the chemical approach to health and disease. This approach is not new. Alexis Carrel, M.D., discussed the need for better knowledge of man in 1935 in his book, Man, the Unknown. Men cannot follow modern civilization along its present course, because it is degenerating. They have been fascinated by the beauty of the sciences of inert matter. They have not understood that their body and consciousness are subjected to natural laws, more obscure than, but as inexorable as, the laws of this ideal world. Neither have they understood that they cannot transgress these laws without being punished. They must, therefore, learn the necessary relations of the cosmic universe, of their fellow men, of their inner selves and also their tissues and their minds. Humanity's attention must turn from the machine and the world of inanimate matter to the body and the soul of man. Dr. Carrel goes on to expose the tragic consequences resulting from our persistent ignorance about our basic nature. This book is not intended to provide the kind of proof customarily demanded by orthodox science. I have evidence to satisfy my requirement of proof. The strict limitations of science precludes experimental study of human subjects. Since no experiment using human subjects can be repeated exactly, perhaps it will become necessary for science to postulate a new paradigm. Lacking this wider view, science excludes research that could reveal the true nature of the human mind, the nature of consciousness and answer the question of survival after physical death. I am convinced that as humans we consist of an eternal indestructible soul spirit living in a physical body. The present body is only one of many we have inhabited through the centuries and which we will subsequently inhabit until we learn our lessons sufficiently well to qualify for a permanent home in a non-physical paradise. This conviction arises out of my own memory going all the way back to creation and the reports of past life memories of patients, trainees and colleagues. These memories include past lives in other bodies, past deaths and vivid memories of the experience between one death and the next entry into a physical body through birth. I have treated this matter at length in my book, Mind Probe Hypnosis. This evidence has largely been gathered using hypnosis as the tool for exploration. Other evidence includes near-death, out-of-the-body, dreams and meditation as well as mystical and psychedelic experiences. Perhaps the largest single body of evidence is the work of Edgar Cayce, the American mystic who produced over 10 million words during readings between 1900 and 1945 while deeply hypnotized. This material has been preserved by the Association for Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and is now available on a CD-ROM disc. The material in this present book comprises a new approach to human problems that has proved to be effective when other methods of treatment have failed. It presumes that we each consist of an immortal soul spirit dwelling in a physical body. When the body dies, the indwelling entity leaves and has choices to make. It may go to the resting, learning place called the light. It may choose to stay near the dead body's burial place. It may stay around a familiar place or object or may attach to a living person. Those who fail to go to the light miss the opportunity to review past experiences, to learn from them and to prepare for a new beginning again by rebirth into an infant body. The natural laws spoken of by Dr. Alexis Carrel are particularly applicable in reference to our multiple lives, deaths and rebirths. The laws of karma determine the effects of choices made. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Galatians 6:7. The result may be either pleasant or unpleasant. Karma need not be thought of as punishment only. Rather, it is best thought of as the result of our own past choices, or at times the result of a need to be persuaded to learn when we are resisting the learning. I am convinced that all past experiences are permanently recorded in our memory and are retrievable using a variety of methods. All that is required to retrieve these early memories is the desire to recall them, simple techniques for quieting the usual mental noise, looking within and asking appropriate questions. Hypnosis is an aid for such retrieval. There is absolutely no need for anyone to be kept in ignorance of their immortality in both directions, past and future, of the nature of death and all available options following the death of the physical body. The universe has provided a place for our soul spirit to go for a between life sojourn. Unfortunately, few people have become aware while in the body that such a place exists. Few people have sought these answers and therefore have only a limited understanding of what the dying experience will be like. At the death of the body, many are surprised and confused by the sudden realization that they are not dead although their body has ceased to function. Some even fail to realize that their body has died. This confusion appears to be the chief reason for the so-called dead to remain earthbound or to attach to a living person. Those that do attach to a living person often have a profound effect on their host, and may cause physical, emotional, behavioral or mental changes. These changes can include serious illness, addiction to drugs or alcohol, personality changes, phobias, inability to succeed at a chosen career, suicidal thoughts or a myriad of other problems. The idea that spirits of the so-called dead might be around us, attached to us or even interfering with our performance or behavior is felt by many to be repugnant, frightening or even terrifying. I was recently visited by a couple who were troubled and frightened because the wife's sister who had died some months earlier had repeatedly appeared in their apartment. My initial response to their story was, "Let's suppose that instead of your sister's dying, you had died. Then you wanted to go visit her. How would you feel if she acted the way you are acting? She is no more to be feared than when she was wearing her body. She is not there to frighten or confuse you. She apparently does not know the proper place to go." Dr. Edith Faw's book, The Unquiet Dead, has the exact instructions to be given to those spirits who hang around familiar places or people instead of going to the light. The couple recorded the four instructions on tape and played the tape during the night. The dead sister did not appear again. If this book does nothing more than help people to know what to expect at death, then it will have served a useful and very badly needed purpose. Each of us must face death. Knowing what it will be like and what choices are most appropriate when the body 11 dies can save so much unnecessary pain and suffering. Various theologies have told us what the afterlife will be like. There seems to be little observable evidence to support common theology. Such ideas as that at death we enter into eternal rest, or wait patiently in our grave for the resurrection, or go immediately to the feet of Jesus or perhaps to everlasting punishment in hell are not substantiated by experience. I have treated hundreds of my patients using non-directive hypnotherapy. When they are guided into past time to locate a cause of their illness or problem, they may regress to an event in their childhood in the present life. However, most of them go much further back to re-experience incidents in former lives, often including vivid details of earlier deaths. Intense emotions are common. The descriptions they give of these earlier experiences have all been consistent with each other and with the philosophical comments contained in the Edgar Case readings. My reasoning is that if these reports were not illustrative of the way the universe is actually organized, surely someone of the hundreds of cases would contradict, deny or refute. The patients that I have worked with tell me that at the end of a former life they can view their dead body from above, can choose to stay around loved ones or a beloved place, can move on to a beautiful place or may decide to attach to the body of a living person. I am both impatient and saddened that so few people are willing to test theological doctrine by actual experience. A general assumption exists that a belief in reincarnation and karma is unchristian. Until 543 AD, when the Emperor Justinian attacked the reincarnation concept, it was part of early Christian understanding. Origen, an early Christian writer, stated in his work, De Principis, the soul has neither beginning nor end. Every soul comes to this 12-world strengthened by the victories or weakened by the defects of its previous life. Its place in this world as a vessel appointed to honor or dishonor is determined by its previous merits or demerits. Its work in this world determines its place in the world which is to follow this. Chapter 1: Possession or Attachment by Entities. My experience has led me to accept the concept that we can be and often are invaded or possessed by beings or entities in addition to our own soul spirit. This book is intended to be a handbook for those who wish to learn to locate, identify, dialogue with and release those entities who might be in or around a living person for a variety of reasons. The ideal would be to find all such trespassers and send them to their proper place. This is a huge undertaking. As more trained workers enter this field, the sooner there will be hope of total success. Edith Farr, Ph.D., author of The Unquiet Dead, and William Baldwin, Ph.D., author of Spirit Releasement Therapy, a Technique Manual, have been the leading educators and trainers in depossession and spirit releasement work. They have developed very effective techniques for recognizing, confronting and persuading attached or possessing spirits to leave their hosts and go to a better place. In doing this work, Farr, Baldwin and others have also found that some attachments are not those who formerly had a human body of their own, but came from a place of darkness and have assignments of causing pain, harm, confusion or disharmony. This work is related to exorcism in that the attached or possessing entities are removed. It differs in that we send them to a safe, beneficial place rather than just casting them to where they could return to original host or to someone else. The dark entities might be loosely classified as demons, but I have found very few who exhibit the traditional demon qualities. They seem more to be rather unbright, bratty underlings of some more powerful dark authority. One possibility is that they are merely the result of negative thinking. This book will have much to say about how to deal with both the earthbound, those who once had bodies of their own, and the dark ones. Both Farr and Baldwin emphasize working directly with the person who has the attachment. This method appears to be very effective. My own question about such a method is, how great a part does suggestion play in producing the results? It seems to me that the changes reported might possibly be due to hypnotic suggestion alone. Because of this possibility, and because I prefer all possible assurance that I am doing what I think I am doing, I have chosen remote depossession as preferable. By this remote method, the one being treated need not know of or consciously participate in the process. We also do remotes with the person being scanned present with us. We always ask permission of the high self of the target person and proceed only after permission has been granted. If the high self responds with either a no or a not now, we do not continue. Transcripts of a few actual cases, to be included later, will illustrate the step-by-step procedure. This is easy to learn and relatively easy to do. However, I do not recommend this technique for the timid therapist. Boldness, assertiveness and fearlessness on the part of the hypnotherapist are assets for this work. Chapter 2: Requirements for a Remote Depossession. 1. Trained hypnotherapist. To prepare for this work, the therapist needs to be trained in both directive and non-directive techniques. Another requirement is a thorough understanding of the philosophy behind regression or past life therapy. There also needs to be an awareness of the potential of the hypnotized person's inner wisdom. Self-confidence and self-assertiveness are most helpful. The timid had best not become involved in depossession work. 2. Willing hypnotized subject. Willingness and interest in this work are essential. We also require approval of the hypnotized person's inner wisdom. 3. The induction. There are many suitable inductions to help the subject reach a satisfactory depth of hypnosis. Each therapist develops techniques with which they are comfortable and which for them produce satisfactory results. I usually select a progressive relaxation beginning either at the top of the head or in the feet. I ask the subject to imagine a wave of relaxation slowly moving over their body, allowing the substance of the wave to just soak in and pervade them totally. I suggest also that the subject imagine that each inhaled breath is pure relaxation and allow this to produce waves throughout the body. I suggest that they also let each exhaled breath carry any tension or discomfort up and out. I emphasize the importance of allowing the tongue to lie loose and limp on the floor of the mouth. Before awakening the subject after the first long induction, I say, in the future, if there is an occasion for us to work together, I will take your left hand in my left hand and count from 1 to 21. If you are willing, by the time I reach 21, you will be deeply relaxed and ready for the work we propose to do. You will remain in control. Your inner wisdom will guide your choices as to whether to accept or reject whatever I say to you, whether to answer my questions or to remain silent. The second and all subsequent times I work with a subject, I use this post-hypnotic suggestion of the left hand to left hand and the 21 count. I then instruct the subject to go to the correct level of relaxation for the work we propose to do and indicate that they have reached this level by nodding their head. I have found several advantages to the use of this post-hypnotic induction. The subject seems to find a degree of comfort and security from holding my hand. I am able to gauge the degree of relaxation as their left hand and arm grow limp and heavy. The instruction about remaining in control serves the purpose of easing any anxiety the subject might have about losing control. Although there is plenty of evidence that control is never lost, many people still react as if this danger does exist. 4. Selecting the target to be scanned. We may begin with a list of 2, 3 or 4 names and addresses of people who have requested remote depossession by mail, or whose names have been chosen by those present. At times the person for whom we are doing the remote is present in the room. The inner wisdom of the hypnotized subject is consulted with a question such as, is it appropriate for you to do a remote scanning of aura at this time? We continue only after being given approval. We may ask about several names at one time, or ask approval of each one individually, moving to the second and subsequent names after the first remote depossession is completed. 5. Locating the target to be scanned. The hypnotized person, scanner, is asked to send a part of their consciousness to an address and locate the target person. If we do not know the exact location of the one to be scanned at the time we are working, but know their location at an earlier time, the hypnotized person can find them at the earlier time. We have been successful going back in time as far as a month. It is likely that an even longer time could be utilized. The scanner recognizes when the target has been located and nods their head or tells that the target has been found. 6. Permission of the high self of the target is requested. 7. After permission is granted, we instruct the hypnotized subject to scan thoroughly both the body of the target and also the periphery and report anything they find that appears to indicate a presence. Common comments may include, there's a black area in the head and the right shoulder, or there's something in the chest or throat or leg. Sometimes only one area is noted, more commonly two or more. 8. Identifying the type of entity. Speaking to the entity, you who are causing the darkness in, target, come forward, speak through, scanner, without harming her, him in any way or give her, him your thoughts and let them speak for you and identify yourself. Do you have a name? Earthbounds, those who have lived in a physical, human body, usually say yes or give a name. Dark entities usually remain silent, or may say something like, go away, I don't like you, or no. One surprising response was, no, I don't have a name and I want a name. I've worked hard for a name. The two types of entities, earthbound or dark, are treated differently. 9. The earthbound. Some of these don't know that they are dead, they are confused or feel lost. Questions are chosen to help them comprehend their true condition. They often need to be guided through their death experience in order to realize that though their body has died, they continue to exist or live in their non-physical state. We ask if they had been told about the light, the proper place to go after the body dies. Answers are varied. A few admit knowing about the light but thought themselves to be unworthy because of their wickedness, their drunkenness or, in one case, a black man felt that they didn't let his kind in. Many say they do not know of the light.